Okay, so it's the last week I sort of get the last word. Not exactly as there is a big wrap-up session. So I'd like to thank Sean for including me here in the last week, although we've had to go back and forth about the length of stay and all of that. So my title is somewhat cryptic, and I hope to clarify what I mean exactly by this. So I'd like to thank my collaborators, Mohammad Edalati, who is right here, right, sitting next to Joe, who is his, well, not his academic grandfather, but close to it. One of my students, Kawai Low, and then another student of Rob's, Rob Lee, another graduate student of my, Seung Min Hong. Right, I know, it's... Okay, so what I want to show is, I want to focus on the Mott problem, and I want to focus on this holographically, and then I want to show that you can understand the essence of what I call Mottness from a holographic setup. Now, since I am a car-carrying solid-state physicist, I have to sort of motivate why it is I have moved into this field. If you look at the unsolved problems in solid state, at least a few of them, they all involve finding new degrees of freedom. It's really all physics of strong coupling. And if you look at the number of tools that we have in our field for strong coupling, they're all listed here. We really don't have very many. We have one if you're interested in calculating correlation functions for things like the Hubbard model. Let me just review that. If you have some strongly correlated system described by the Hubbard model, for example, if you shrink that down to a dot and embed that in a non-interacting environment, this is a leading candidate for explaining strongly correlated systems in our field of solid state, and this is the dynamical mean field approximation. And the key thing here is that you replace this whole system, which has physics and all length scales, by a local degree of freedom, and only the interactions are only on this dot. So the natural question which arises is, why is it that this should at all describe the long wavelength physics? In other words, why should we believe this at low energies? It's really a local probe. And so my statement is, the only difference between this and a theory is that this is not a theory. And this stems from the fact that there's really no justification for it working at long wavelengths. Okay, so the key question that you have when you're trying to construct a low-energy theory of some strongly coupled system is, how precisely do you go from here to there? Now, a standard approach, if you had a fermionic system, a bosonic system, would be to integrate out the degrees of freedom here. So you integrate out, you get some flow equations, and you understand the low-energy physics evolving from a correct integration of the high-energy self. Now, if your system is fermionic, it's typically hard to do this. And in particular, if new degrees of freedom emerge once you start eliminating the high-energy scales. Now, the RG is typically not smart enough to figure out what to do with those as you perform this sort of transformation. And this is a serious problem that we face in solid state, especially if you're interested in high TC, because you really are trying to understand what are the weakly interacting degrees of freedom, what are the degrees of freedom which make the Hubbard model, for example, essentially weakly interacting. So this doesn't really give you very much information. An approach which is widespread in our field is to use what I call the 1 over ego expansion, which is, if you know what the answer is, then You simply just write down the answer, and there's no reason to go and include any other terms. And so there are any number of guesses as to what the low energy physics is of the Hubbard model, but it's really not systematic. Now, one of the things that you see immediately from just looking at the beta function which arises from any sort of RG is that it's entirely local in energy. If it's local in energy, this should translate into locality in space. And this is the essential idea behind the Maldacena conjecture, that this extra dimension really has to do with the running of the RG scale as you move along here, and the coupling constant is decreasing as you move from the UV into the deep IR. So you've essentially geometrized the RG of this system. So we have some strongly coupled quantum mechanical system defined in terms of operators. And in the bulk of this system is, you know, some particular space-time. And we have fields in here which are acting as sources to these operators. The value they acquire at the boundary is exactly the value they need to act as the source. And the coupling at the boundary is very simple. It's just that the value of this at the boundary so that it's the source for this particular operator. So once you have this in terms of some kind of source, then you can just go and do field theory in the standard way. And the key claim is that the partition function for this strongly coupled system is just the action, the on-shell action on ADS evaluated with these fields at the value of the boundary so that they are the sources for these operators. Okay, so given this, at least my understanding of this has led me to try to see if we can use any of this technology to understand what I consider to be some of the deeper problems in solid state. Okay, so what does holography do for you? Well, the standard thing that you normally see is, in the standard within the Landau-Ginzburg type paradigm, you start with some Hamiltonian, you identify a length scale, and then you break the system up into these correlation volumes, and you write down flow equations. In holography, this is really the key equation. RG is GR, okay? I mean, and we really mean that. I mean, the geometry does the RG for you. Okay, because your strongly coupled system is replaced by geometry. So strong coupling is easy, at least from the gravity side. What is hard is figuring out what is the, if you were to do a top-down construction, what is the UV theory, or how do you start from a UV theory, whatever you have to go to do that, and then figure out what is the equivalent gravity construction of that. Now, when we started doing this with Mohamad, what we were trying to do is construct the gravity dual of the Hubbard model. We have not obtained any publishable results on that yet, but the other way, we have obtained some rather interesting results. Okay, so given that there's this technology out there, the question we ask is, can we use holography to solve the Mott problem? So by the Mott problem, I mean the following. The Mott problem came about from Mott trying to understand nickel oxide. And nickel oxide is D8. For the string theorists, D is the number of, it's a quantum. You guys know what D8 means, it's not number of dimensions, its electronic structure. Okay, so it's a half-filled band, and as you turn on the interactions, something rather non-perturbative happens, a gap opens, and although there might be things having to do with symmetry breaking that obtain, they are not the ultimate cause of the gap in the system. So it's a gap in a paramagnetic state, and hence there's no symmetry breaking. Okay, so there are there is a wide range of phenomena that goes along with the Mott problem. But first of all, why is the Mott problem important? Of course, you all know all high-temperature superconductors, at least in the copper oxide systems, are all Mott insulators, and hence identifying what are the weakly interacting degrees of freedom surrounding the Mott problem is, of course, a paramount problem. Okay, now there are a series of experimental facts that go along with the Mott problem if you say that you've solved the Mott problem. Here is vanadium oxide, and this is the optical conductivity. So you can shine light on the system, see where is the absorption. Okay, so let's start here at high temperatures. At high temperatures, there's spectral weight down here at zero energy. And there's also some weight up here. But as you cool the system down, and it's entirely a very reasonable temperature, essentially room temperature, the spectral weight which was here goes away and is transferred to states essentially, so 20,000 wave numbers is 2 eV. So it's transferred to states on the order of 2 or 3, 4, 6 eV, if this were to keep going, away from the chemical potential. So the opening of this gap is really tied to physics on all energy scales. And the other thing that is apparent is that the gap itself is much smaller than any energy scale associated with the range where spectral weight is transferred. Okay, so this sort of rearrangement of the spectrum on all energy scales has nothing to do with ordering. Okay, if you go above any ordering temperature, this physics still survives. Okay, now Mott was plagued by there were disbelievers at the time that the Mott transition really had anything to do with anything other than a symmetry breaking transition. But Mott pointed out in 1976 that although vanadium oxide does in fact undergo a structural transition in which there's some sort of local rearrangement, that energy scale associated with dimerization is much smaller than anything having to do with the scale of the gap. And hence, this cannot account for the opening of the gap here. He, of course, did not know about this experiment, which in fact shows that the physics is much richer than just saying there's a disconnect between any energy scale associated with ordering and that having to do with the onset of the gap. Now, this is vanadium oxide. And the same thing happens in any high-temperature superconductor. This one is as a function of doping here. You see in the as close as you can get to the insulating state in the YBCO, you have a nice gap. And as you dope the system, all of this spectral weight from up here fills in here, and hence there's this dynamical transfer of spectral weight in the system.
What was the blue line again? Where on the
phase
line?
To
the left, under the
Yeah, you can't really make Y equals 6.0, which would be the insulator.
Oh, so it's under the
Yeah. It's as close as you can get to the insulating state of YBCO.
So then there are lots of ordering scales.
Right. But certainly none of them would explain either this gap, if you can extrapolate this to Y equals 0, or the transfer of spectral weight over all of these scales.
Is there a thermodynamic phase transition between the
superconductors? At point of temperature, there is. I mean, superconductivity happens.
But in between those two temperatures?
Between here and here? Okay, so there is. No, there isn't. There isn't. Not between here and here. Right. The only thing that's going on is the opening of this gap. Okay, so the question since this is our garden variety strongly coupled system, the question I ask is, can you construct a gravitational theory in which you can honestly say there's a gap in the fermionic sector? In other words, you construct you go and calculate the retarded green function, compute its imaginary part, and you're asking, is it zero? Or is it below some value that you just don't care about? And this is happening spontaneously. So that's the question I want to focus on. Okay, if you can do this, I will call that a dynamical generation of a gap, and I will argue that you can say then is a Mott gap, because it has a lot of the associated properties that we see in Mott systems. Okay, now let me just review how these calculations are done. So one replaces the action for your strongly coupled system with a geometry and a gauge field which will set the chemical potential. One can probe what's going on in this system by some fields which are acting as sources now for the corresponding fermionic operator at the boundary. And in the bulk of your system, you can describe these sources by some kind of a wave equation. In this case, will just be the Dirac equation. At least that's one certain possibility. I'm sort of reviewing the standard thing which was done by John here and Conrad. Use infalling boundary conditions, or your solutions at the boundary in the standard quantization. It can be written in this form, and hence the retarded Green function would just be a ratio of the condensate to the source. And the key thing here is that B and A, although this is the Green function at the boundary, these are not just related to the UV variables. These really are functions of what is going on deep into the bulk of your system. So in other words, the charge and the scaling dimension of your fields. And also, it's determined by KF, and hence the UV variable will be the Fermi momentum. And that, in fact, will so this Green function then will have a mixture of UV and IR degrees of freedom. And it's because of this UV-IR mixing that you will see certain kinds of features coming about which are crucial to understanding this problem. Okay, so the Fermi surfaces are just obtained by setting A equal to zero. I'm looking at the nature of those poles. Okay, now there's a slight problem that comes about when you write down the Dirac equation in this curved spacetime, as John has eloquently told us how to think about it. Namely, the omega equals zero limit is slightly problematic, but your equations decouple. If you introduce this kind of scaling, and they'll decouple and give you essentially a new kind of geometry in the bulk of the system, indicated here. So it's an ADS2 cross R2. And what this means now is that you can identify at the horizon a new conformal operator which will be dual to the field associated with this part of the geometry. And your Green function at the boundary will be a function of your ADS2, at least the Green function for the conformal operator O plus minus. Okay, so all of this can be done, and this will typically acquire some kind of power law. Okay, now, what's interesting about this emergent symmetry, this new emergent geometry in the bulk of the system, is that it's rather different from the original one. Namely, it is scale invariant without scaling x at all. And as a result, it's acting as if z is equal to infinity. And hence, the system has a finite entropy at zero temperature. And this is a function entirely of the fact that there is a horizon in this problem. And all of the boundary physics is really determined by the physics of this ADS2 region. Okay. So what kinds of results have been obtained? Well, as you well know, the MIT group, the Leiden group, McMaster, to some extent. The probe equation has been a Dirac equation. One of the key results is this omega log omega dependence in the cell energy characteristic of a marginal Fermi liquid. Okay, now the question we want to ask is, what probe equation should you use such that if you do this and you go and calculate the imaginary part of G, you in fact see a complete suppression of the spectral weight. So one can rephrase this question. How do you destroy the Fermi surface? These nice Fermi poles, which several people have identified. So the standard way that one can rephrase this question, you can destroy these Fermi surfaces if you come up with some mechanism for decoherence. Now, holography offers you a natural way of getting decoherence. If you look at the imaginary part of the green function, just the spectral function that John computed, you see that there is a pole right here near the Fermi surface, but then there's this broad region over here, which I will tell you more about in a minute, but this is the log oscillatory regime. If you could move all of these poles into the log oscillatory regime by some mechanism, then you would essentially have a way of getting decoherence.
These two plots are driven by K or no omega?
This is K right here.
So what are the two lines, the two components? So it's like positive and negative omega or something?
Right. Okay. Okay, now the thing that, at this level, since you're really just doing a probe approximation, there's nothing fundamental about writing down the Dirac equation. I mean, there would be if somehow your gravity theory was fixed by, you know, some top-down construction. But there's nothing fundamental about it. In other words, there are several terms that one needs to consider, or that can be considered in this setup, and then you would simply ask the question, how do they affect the physics at the boundary? Okay, now if you were doing, for example, quantum electrodynamics, and you're interested in the anomalous magnetic moment of the electron, one of the terms that you would add, or the term that, a term that can be added, which in fact contributes to the anomalous magnetic moment, is this F slash term, is this the F mu nu gamma mu nu. And this term has been studied since 1949, at least for anomalous magnetic moment of an electron. Okay, and I'm sure that in a gravity setup, it would also lead to an anomalous magnetic moment in the bulk of the system. So the question we want to ask is, since this term is allowable, what does this give rise to at the boundary? Okay, now in the condensed matter community, I've only seen this term mentioned once, and that was in someone wrote a paper which I think several people have commented on, which is wrong, so I won't say anything further about this, but it's in the context of Chern-Simons type theories for the quantum Hall effect. So I simply want to study what is the effect of this term. So what does this correspond to at the boundary? Okay, so here is a recalculation of the MIT results. You get a nice Fermi surface. And this is for now the magnitude of this Pauli term equal to zero. So our results should just be exactly what they obtained, and they in fact are. So I just want to slowly take you along here as we increase the value of P. Okay, so there is a range in which P doesn't do very much. If you look at the real and the imaginary parts of the excitation energies, what you end up with is something that looks very Fermi liquid-like. There's also a special point now, which is shifted away from the point that John identified, because P does couple to the scaling dimension of your fermionic spinner, and hence it changes the point at which you get the marginal Fermi liquid behavior. And there's also a range in which you get non-Fermi liquid behavior. But all of this is, you know, we understood from John's paper. So as far as P is concerned, if you only study P up to 1 over the square root of 6, there is nothing new. Okay, so the question I ask is, what happens when P is bigger than 4.2? Which is a number I didn't just pull out of a hat, but it is a number at which something interesting starts to happen. Okay, so what happens is the following. This picture turns into this picture. Okay? So the spectral weight, which was at the chemical potential, is no longer there. So it's below some value that I defined to be 0, which was 10 to the minus 9. If you wanted 10 to the minus 100, I could find a value of P for which this statement is true. Okay? And the spectral weight, which was here, has now shifted below. Okay, so there is an opening of a gap. Now this F mu nu gamma mu nu term doesn't break any symmetries. And hence, if this really is a gap, it's dynamically generated, and this gap is coming along with transfer of spectral weight. Okay, so what I want to do is explain why this result is coming about. Now, when we obtained this result, I showed this to my colleague Eduardo Franken, and he said this is absolute nonsense. Because the Mott gap really evokes rather visceral reactions from people. Because if you show them something which doesn't break any symmetry, you know, people like symmetry. It's very easy to, you know, get your hands on symmetry, but if something doesn't break any symmetries, then, you know, they get all upset.
Sorry. The value of 4.2, does it depend on the mass of the fermion, or?
Yeah, it does. It does. I will mention the precise regime where this happens. I will delineate it very shortly.
And this spectral weight transfer is because of some rule that you have to also satisfy. It's transferred somewhere else. Is this like?
Not exactly.
Yeah, okay. It's a total spectral weight finite. Because this came up before a few weeks ago. And
well, there is a sum rule on the total spectral weight, but where it gets transferred to is very specific to the mechanism by which the gap is generated. I mean, if you break a symmetry, for example, the spectral weight is never transferred on anything more than, you know, maybe 2 times the gap. It's on the order of the gap, like in BCS.
But these individual fermions have individual sum rules.
These individual fermions. You mean,
well, this spectral, this two-point function you're calculating.
Right.
Yes.
At least I would think. You know, I would think so. In other words, okay. So what you're trying to say is it tied to the chemical, to the gauge field that I have in the bulk? Okay. We haven't explored exactly the nature of that, but I think I can tell you why this is happening.
Is there a semi-holographic way of understanding this?
Semi-holographic way. You mean from the Hubbard model?
No, not really, because it's mainly coming from you. It's from the IR physics, you know what's going on. And,
so the F mu nu that you have,
but it just shifts into momentum.
I will get to that, okay? I will get to this.
Can I ask something else? So in the right picture, K, I mean, if there's no K, no, okay, no. Basically, I mean, if you just turn on P a little, you think that it just moves KF.
Okay, so as I said, I walked you through several values of P, and for small values, nothing happens. Now, I will show you exactly what P is doing deep in the IR. You just write down the equations of motion, expand them around equal zero, and you'll see, as Mohammad has told you, it's shifting K around, but it's doing so differently for plus and minus K.
Okay, so you
okay.
How that works.
Yeah. And that's actually tied to the spectral wave transfer. Okay, as I said, Eduardo didn't believe this result, but then again, he doesn't believe any result I get, but it was nice that it was confirmed by people who have, you know, reasonable credentials in the string theory field, so I didn't care that Eduardo thought it was wrong. Okay? And if you're listening, Eduardo, so anyway. okay. So let me explain. So here is, in fact, Julian Soner's result. Now, this is a slightly different setup, but I'll tell you how it is different. But this Pauli term is also opening, it's leading to a huge suppression of the spectral waves. Okay, now, what's going on? What is the mechanism for this? Okay, now, we have these fields propagating in the bulk, and they have this sort of asymptotic form. And this is determining what KF is at the boundary. Now, the question I want to ask is, where is KF as a function of P? Okay, now what is going on in this problem is the following. This region right here is the phase space for which the scaling dimension of the IR, of the is essentially the operator which is sort of dual to the fermionic operator, which is dual to the ADS2 region, where its scaling dimension becomes complex. Okay, and KF is marching along here, and for P larger than 1 over the square root of 6, there are no poles of this green function outside this region. They all lie in here. So this is the log oscillatory regime. Okay, so the real claim is that the green function, which is B over A is equal to 0 only in this log oscillatory regime. So the slope of KF and essentially this log oscillatory regime are tracking one another. This is P.
No,
I mean for the
It turns out that it shrinks and then it grows again.
Yeah. As a function of P, okay? I mean you must
have. That also happens when P is 0. Okay, it also passes through 0. This is function of 1 as a function of sometimes just M over.
Yeah, I mean right. Because you know that. Okay, fine. Okay. Now, why is KF evolving as a function of P? And as I said, you can simply expand your equations in the ADS2 region. And the key point is that P is entering your equations of motion essentially as a mass term, but it's a mass coupled to sigma 1. And what it's doing is it's moving plus and minus K in different directions. So as it's shifting them, it's moving the spectral weight around. For P large enough, it's moving all of the spectral weight away from where you would normally have a pole. I mean, a well-defined quasi-particle. Now, if you look at the scaling dimension of O plus minus, it looks like this. Now, if mk squared, if the value of q is such that this term is smaller than this, the scaling dimension of this operator will in fact be complex. And that is defining the log oscillatory regime. And what we find is that it looks like p is going, as you crank up p, you're going to move outside the log oscillatory region, but that's not true. If you look at this very carefully, what you find is that this thing is complex and there is, and that's exactly where KF is moving. Okay. So, what does this actually mean? Okay, so what does a complex scaling dimension mean?
So, I just wanted to check in. So the Fermi surface disappears without KF going to 0, right? So, KF is some finite number, and then suddenly it's not a pole anymore. So,
okay, so
just checking. I think that's what you said.
Without P or
without KF?
Yeah, that's right.
So it's not that it shrinks; it just
There, the only zeros of A are within the log oscillatory regime as you crank up P. Now, nominally, or sort of a priori, you might have thought that you just move right through the log oscillatory regime and then go out the other side. But if you saw the solutions there, is that they're tracking one another. And that's the key point. Okay, so what does a complex scaling dimension mean? Okay, so let me just review some very simple things about scaling. So if you're at some critical point, where generally is, you know, we associate this with some sort of continuous scale invariance, you can introduce your theory is invariant regardless of the parameter that you choose. And this manifests itself in this ratio being independent of lambda. Okay, so this is continuous scale invariance, and if this is true, your exponents are always real. Okay, so delta then is independent of the scale. Now, the general condition that you were solving for continuous scale invariance is that this thing has to equal 1. But 1 is really e to the I, e to the 2 pi I n. So the solution to that equation in general is this, that your exponent will depend on the particular scale that you chose. N equals 0 just corresponds to continuous scale invariance. So when you, and this is an example of discrete scale invariance, and hence the title of my talk. So it is scaling which depends on the particular magnification or the particular scale that you choose. So general discrete scale invariance is scaling with a particular scale raised to an arbitrary integer. Now, in this particular case, the log oscillatory regime is characterized by this kind of scaling in frequency space, as first pointed out by John, but not too much more was made of it. Okay, so let me just give you an example of discrete scale invariance. Many of you know this example is just a Cantor set. If you just take this line segment and chop it into thirds, take out the middle segment, then do this again, at each iteration, the length of each segment has gone down by 3, and the number of segments has gone up by n. This is actually characterized by a complex scaling exponent, and it's indicated right here. It is unfortunate this is so low, you can't see this. This system is scale invariant with respect to a particular number here raised to any integer power. And this is discrete scale invariance. So discrete scale invariance is really telling you about some fundamental length scale, or if it's discrete scale invariance in energy, it's telling you about some fundamental energy scale. Now, I put to you that if, in fact, you're seeing discrete scale invariance in frequency, it's telling you that there's some fundamental organizing energy scale in the problem. But it's the origin of the discrete scale invariance. Okay, just like if you're seeing this in the for some hierarchical system, there's some particular magnification that you need to reproduce the original system. So in this case, there has to be some fun, there's some energy that you need to understand the rest of the spectrum.
Maybe some short-distance.
No, well, okay. So it's different from what you would normally identify as a standard IR or UV length scales. Okay, discrete scaling is not anything having to do with that. It's some new fundamental energy scale in the problem. Now, it's not fundamental in the sense that it's, you know, related to the fundamental fields that you had, but I mean, it's fundamental in the sense that that's the way the spectrum now is organized.
Do you these fixed points with this screen, scaling there, are they stable in the sense that?
Yeah.
Calculating like higher orders, do you see again? Like you showed a beta function, which was like just using the dimensional, the engineering dimension of the operator.
Mm-hmm.
If you start going to higher orders, like, do you still see this thing? Or is not there?
It would still be there. Okay, now the problem is that it's very easy to come up with Lagrangians in the standard Landau paradigm that break continuous scale invariance. It's very hard to write one down that breaks continuous scale invariance down to discrete scale invariance. Okay, which is why what you can do is construct beta functions. You can write down beta functions for toy models that make discrete scale invariance manifest. And this has been done recently by the U of Washington group. And what they have been trying to understand is, really, is discrete scale invariance a paradigm for a new kind of phase transition? And so what they did is they said, let's consider a toy beta function. And the key thing about in the construction of this beta function, since it's sort of reverse engineering, is that there are two fixed points in the system. And you identify the one with the larger coupling constant G plus as the UV fixed point, and this one with the minus sign as the IR fixed point. And their whole point is that discrete scale invariance is about a collapse of these two fixed points. It's a merging of these two fixed points as a function of the parameters in your theory. Okay, so what I mean by that is the following. If you just plot the beta function as a function of this coupling constant, you see that there are two well-defined fixed points. And at these two fixed points identify conformal phases of your theory. Okay? Because everything's real. Now, as you change G, for example, or say as you change alpha, so in other words, this equals alpha star, these two fixed points merge and you just end up with one. Now if you decrease alpha even further, this term becomes negative and your solutions for G, in fact, lie in the complex plane. The solutions for beta equals zero lie in the complex plane. So now let's start doing this RG. For a value of alpha slightly less than alpha star. So you're sitting roughly right around here. But the value of your coupling constant is on the UV side. The beta function will flow to a region where beta gets small, and then it will start diverging, regardless of what the UV scale was, which means you'll cleanly identify an IR length scale in the problem. And that IR length scale is indicated right here. And this is exactly the form of the length scale that is in Kosterless Thouless transitions. So their point is that any time you have a merging of two fixed points, a UV and an IR fixed point, you have discrete scale invariance because you've broken the conformal. This breaks conformal invariance, and a general way of understanding what the result of that is that there is this fundamental length scale which is emerging. Okay. So, this was not exactly organized, right? But I said all the things on this. Okay, so underlying what I think is going on is this picture. It looks like I only have time for the first part of my talk, which is fine. I'll just do the holography. Okay, now, so let's look at this slightly closer. If we now examine where, in other words, if we just look at this much more, if I look at the ratio which determines my dream function, and I simply ask the question, do I get a solution for alpha equaling zero lying outside, this is the log oscillatory regime, as I crank up P, the answer is no. Okay, so this is this red or this black curve. As I crank up P, this thing distracts and goes up here. It does not go down here, which means any zero of any time alpha is equal to zero, it can only be in the log oscillatory regime. And this is true for any value of P that we used. Now, generally speaking, okay, so this means then that Mott physics and discrete scale invariants are linked. Now, generally speaking, if you have discrete scale invariants, and it's coming about because a certain exponent is complex, this generally means you violated the BF bound. And what this means is that you have some kind of instability. Instabilities manifest themselves in the imaginary part of an energy moving into the upper half plane. And this generally tells you you have some sort of condensate. Okay, and Mohammad and I have written some papers on this where we've looked at a scalar condensate in the electron star background of Sean's. It's identified by violation of the BF bound on the interior. Okay.
You think that's just in the IR region?
There's
all the way to the
UV. No. Look, remember now, only the IR CFT has this complex exponent. The boundary never has a complex exponent. Yeah, okay. Okay.
This
fermionic
back reaction, which is
okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Can you go back to the previous slide? Yes, there. So if you look at the orange region, is it an annulus in 2D? For the last.
Annulus. Does it wrap? In this phase space here, is an annulus?
Right. That's one dimension. Although if you look at it in two dimensions, then you will have log oscillatory behavior in annulus. So I guess if you go to finite n and look at the back reaction of fermions on the geometry, then you have inhomogeneous solutions.
Oh, I see. You mean some regions which are gaps, some regions which are not. Is that what you mean? The inhomogeneous how? In terms of the density and the
kind of. In terms of x and y directions.
Okay, so I don't know. We didn't consider the back reaction yet. So I don't know what the answer is.
Can part of the reason that we should make a big deal about this about the oscillatory regions is that it's pretty weird. In particular, it's in that there's non-zero spectral light at zero frequency. So that feature of the log oscillatory region seems to be gone in the large P cases that you're studying. In the
special
radius is zero, right?
So let me get to that.
You say, why is that?
That's interesting. So let me get to that. Okay. Okay. So the question is there an instability? So one can do that by simply calculating the quasi-normal modes. And for any peak here in the spectral function that you want to go and look at, you can go and calculate the corresponding energy and its imaginary component. They all lie in the lower half plane. And this makes sense because for fermions, you can't get a condensate. I mean, this would break, a gauge invariance if you have, a condensate of if you take the value of psi, for example, okay? So that's not what is going on. Okay, now to address your question, okay? What is going on? Let's look at the leading pole here. If we look at the imaginary part of the green function, so the residue, this residue is dropping to zero. Okay, so what is going on here is that this numerator, which involves, just the standard coefficient plus this deep IR term, that term is dropping to zero.
B0?
The whole numerator is dropping to zero.
In this case, these non-fermi liquid cases, when mu is less than a half, there was already no.
No, that's not true.
On top of that.
This is only for large enough values of P, okay? is the numerator now dropping to zero? For those values of p where you have this marginal Fermi liquid or non-Fermi liquid, the weight is always finite. Okay.
Not
Omega.
Right.
In other words, there's no. You can't simply say.
Right.
Okay.
If I now do alternative quantization, does that mean I have a huge spectral weight there?
Well, I mean, so what you call the source and the source and the condensate will now be interchanged.
Yeah, I don't know what the value of the mass is, whether you can do that for this, but
this is mass zero.
Then I should be able to do alternative quantization. Then there's an alternative Green's function where just the numerator and the denominator are flipped.
They want to look totally in the same place, I think that's true.
So then what you would have to do then is identify where this thing is equaling zero, okay? Which would be different from where the denominator was equaling zero.
You're saying it's kind of everywhere.
Well, I am saying that.
Or, I mean, the coefficient of the imaginary part of this is not be zero.
Right. Yeah, that's right. So, sorry. Neither is a simple. Okay, yeah. Sorry. That is the answer. Yes. That's right. Okay, so let me just try to wrap this up. Okay, now, this mechanism of, making the weight of some quasi-particle pole drop to zero as a result of some operator which you would naively identify as being sort of irrelevant has actually been seen before. If you just look at the standard superconducting theory and then you add in coupling to fermions and you have an extra term which couples now the bosonic and the fermionic degrees of freedom, by cranking up this coefficient you can get these poles that have zero spectral weight. And you can say then this is increasing the value of the gap. So it's a similar thing that is going on here. But in this case, you already have a symmetry broken gap. So you've already broken the U1 symmetry. In our case, that gap is coming about entirely because of the suppression of these poles without any background that has broken any symmetry. Now, we can do this at finite temperature also. I mean, just, change the value of the charge, and you can see. So this is now in the third dimension. Here is the weight here, and you can see that this gap fills in. And we can ask the question: what is the temperature at which the gap fills in? And what is the ratio of the zero temperature gap to the temperature at which the gap fills in? Now, if we're describing something non-trivial having to do with strong correlations, this should be this ratio should be a number, on the order of 10 or so. And of course, the number is on the order of 10. But it's 10. Okay, so this is, because of this confluence of things, we say then that this gap in the probe fermionic sector really is modeling things, and because of the spectral wave transfer, it is really modeling things that look like the Mach problem. And here is the spectral wave transfer as a function of p. And this is the spectral wave transfer as a function of temperature. All of it is completely consistent with these kinds of optical experiments. Okay, so to summarize, what we've seen is that this rather strange regime, which comes about from this kind of scaling, which is discrete scale invariance, so lambda, so n is now an integer. This has to give rise to an emergent IR scale. The only way of really seeing that is if there's some sort of gap. And this is coming about without any condensate. Okay, so then the question I ask, and I'll sort of leave you with two more transparencies, is the breaking of continuous scale invariance down to discrete scale invariance, is this the symmetry that's ultimately broken in the Mach problem? If it is, it's sort of exciting because it would explain why the Mach problem still persists. One could only have obtained this if you've gone and done holography. If you're looking within the holographic setup, since this gap, since KF is only in the region where the corresponding IR operator does have a complex scaling dimension, the answer is yes. Okay, is this true for vanadium oxide? That vanadium oxide is a system that has discrete scale invariance. And in other words, underlying it is there some sort of merger of a UV and an IR fixed point? Okay, so this is the question. Okay, now I have attempted to answer this question in preparation for this talk. So if you go and look at cases in which you know how to calculate things exactly, it's of no use. You can solve the Hubbard model exactly without any hopping. That's not a dynamical system, and hence you don't see any sort of scaling that is interesting. Beta ansatz, there is no critical point for 1D. So I had to rely on the same sorts of numerics I was trashing at the very beginning. Okay, so here are some numerics on the Mach transition. So using cellular dynamical mean field theory. And the order parameter here is the number of doubly occupied sites. See, there's always double occupancy regardless of the value of U, even if you're in the insulating side of the Mach transition. The real question is, how mobile are these doubly occupied sites? So the general way of thinking about the Mach transition is that there has to be a binding with the empty sites for the system not to be a whole conductor. So on one side, on the insulating side, double occupancy is localized, whereas on the other side, double occupancy forms a fluid. So they should proliferate. And so what people calculate numerically is D minus the critical value of double occupancy as a function of U minus UC. And what they're looking for is a particular sort of non-analytic or jump behavior in the in this quantity. And so these are for two different techniques. They give reasonable agreement. So the question is, how can you describe this? Can you describe this with a simple power law? Well, the function they use to fit this is this. Okay, this is not a simple power law of the scaling. I mean, of the basic control parameter, a delta U, right? It's three different powers. So, I simply ask the question: what if there was this BKT type length scale underlying this? What would you end up with? Okay, so I would say there's a big question mark, and it's sort of encouraging that simple power law physics does not seem to be describing these simulations. But you might also say, well, this is some sort of mean field theory. Why would you expect it to give you anything having to do with the exponents? So what I did is I simply plotted this region right here. That's this, and this is this sort of scaling. I don't know if this is really telling you anything, but it is sort of my main point that perhaps the Mach transition and the reason why it has remained elusive is really about discrete scale invariance and an underlying length scale which looks like this. Okay, that's all I have time for. Yeah, the only adjustable parameter here is gamma. Whereas over here, there are four adjustable parameters. So there's really no wiggle room if you think the fundamental length scale is this BKT type of length scale.
Is it linear if you do a log radial plot?
This is entirely a linear plot.
Right. It would be a straight line.
Right. Okay.
I'm not sure I haven't followed all of this, but on the subject of discrete wonder the holographic setting about it, because it would correspond to the straight breaking of some sort of translation variance in the radial direction.
No, that's a different thing. I mean, we've worried about that because from the very get-go, you might think that, look, you have complete translational variance in all of the coordinates. Why can you describe a system that has a gap in the first place? Okay. Discrete scaling variance offers you a way out of that. And if it is present, okay, and if the physics you see is tied to that. And sort of the difference between this and Julian's work is that, in his case, there isn't a log oscillatory regime. And really what they're seeing is just a suppressed weight near this, the IR component, the green function that was a negative at TU. Does that answer the question, or does it make it more confused?
This just has to do with double trace operators, so you see it in the Green's functions, but not in the background. So it's the Green's function is what else is discrete scale. It's about boundary conditions of operators in the IR.
Yeah, I see that it's something about the
probe sector. So, yeah, so I guess maybe the back reaction might. Yeah, if it persisted, right, if this were to persist with back reaction, then something funny would have to happen.
Right, I mean, we wondered about this in
the
area of
compensation for
all the
discrete. Right, right. Right, right, right. Yeah, look, I mean, discrete scaling, yeah, I mean, you know, because, you know, there are many people who think, you know, that discrete scaling variance has to do with everything. This paper of, you know, Kaplan and Al, I mean, they think QCD, the underlying transition there is, you know, described by discrete scaling variance. And there's some boson which is a messenger of that, you know, breaking from continuous down to discrete scaling variance. So you know, if that's underlying the Mott problem, that would be the second half of my talk, but I only have time for the first half of the talk. So this is a good place to stop. Yeah.
I have one technical point which I didn't get from the talk. So I've seen there are more than one Fermi surfaces.
Not for the value of the charge that we used, okay?
Cool. Would it be interesting to look at the case where the
error is? Yeah.
So did you look at what happens when the one of them disappears or happens to the
new project came up?
Yeah, look, we then went on to the, my office, the guy sitting next to me is Eduardo, okay, so what I'm trying to do is solve all the problems that he's thinking about using holography. So then we decided to see if we could solve the dramatic, right, so then we started looking at scalar type problems, okay, and that just took off, and we haven't gotten back to this problem. One of the things we wanted to look at is, and Sean, you have to help me out on this one, is using your electron star background with the Pauli term to see if there is a, to see what happens to the spectrum. Because there's no log oscillatory region in what you've done. So technically, there shouldn't be a gap.
There's not, right?
There isn't.
This is kind of, I can turn this around to a question. So these log oscillatory regions do indicate instabilities for fermions. They're just not classical.
They aren't classical instabilities, right? All right.
They're out there, and then when you include the back reaction, you sort of lose the log oscillatory region. So I don't.
So the extrapolation would be that for these critical values p larger than p, the electron star background would not be there.
Okay. So this is tied in with the fact that really what might be going on in the log oscillatory region is you get this pair production. And so that you start destroying this horizon and you go over to your case of the star. Okay. Yeah.
So is there any non-holographic reason, it means any condensed matter reason to believe that this kind of broken length scale, whatever is important thing is?
Is there a...
I guess you're showing the UMAX, the micro simulations of actual...
Yeah, but that's not a... He's asking for something deeper than, some numerology, okay? So, I would say that, I would say my argument
it's
would
like
be the following.
Your logic is also okay with me.
No, but it's not fine with me. So let me tell you the reason why I ultimately think there is something going on here. Okay? As you well know, what is one of the classic cases which has discrete scalar variance? What's it really telling you about? It's telling you about FMR bound states. Okay? So these are like, you know, three particle bound states with a two particle in which the scattering is not strong enough to cause a bound state in the two particle channel. Okay, if you look at the, so just forget that there are bosons, okay? If you think about the Mach problem, it really is a binding. The insulating state really has to have double occupancy and empty site localized next to one another. Otherwise, they would be free to move around and you just get a conductor. So there has to be some sort of bound state going on the insulating side. And identifying that length scale, I think, could explain why this sort of scaling might be emerging. That's how I think about it. Yeah.
What is the critical difference between what happens as you vary P, make it large, and what would happen if you just vary
N? N. Okay. Now, if you vary N, yeah, you can certainly get rid of Fermi P. Now, the way that the exponent comes about, the way that M enters the exponent, is that it won't be making M complex.
Sure.
Sorry, it won't be making mu complex. Yeah, okay, so. Yeah, that's true. That is true. It wouldn't be, so that's another way, and I don't know if that would be associated with dynamical spectral wave transfer or any of the other stuff that I know is associated with the Mach problem.
When you use M, does the scale go to zero, or does it go to the...
It doesn't go to zero.
Yeah.
Just
the matter of the case of the mass, large mass, like, when did the W here? That's the nature of the
system.
So, any other questions?
Good.